recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast. Due to technical difficulties, recording was interrupted at this point of the presentation. We will now rejoin the event in progress.
Now think about this. If you owned the water routes in the 1800s, you owned the commerce. To own the water route would be like owning the World Wide Web today. So this new nation decided was if they could find the water route that would take them from the Mississippi River all the way to the Pacific Ocean, they would control all of this section of this new nation, and they would control all the commerce. It was so important that the Spanish government sent two parties to kill Lewis and Clark during their trip, two war parties to kill them. Everybody knew that that water route was there. Everybody. For 300 years, they'd been looking for it. People had already drawn maps that where they projected where they thought it would be. And even when they talked to the Native Americans people, they talked about the fact that there were rivers that ran all the way to the Pacific. So everybody knew, and it was there. They spent the winter with the Mandan tribe in what is now North Dakota. The Mandan tribe told them, you will cross over a great fall, Great Falls, Montana. And then you will come to a place where you will have to cross and carry your boats over a mountain. And then you will find the river. Lewis and Clark sat there on that day, on August 12, 1805, with their feet on both sides. They got so excited because they looked up and they saw a tiny little rise, and they figured they would walk up to that rise, they would call up the men, they would take the canoes, they would carry the canoes a half a day, and then they would put them into the river on the other side, and for the first time in 2 years, they would go downstream. They'd been going upstream for 2 years. They had gone through a hard winter, and now they were finally going to get the wind at their backs and the current going with them, and they looked up, and when they got up to the top, you know what they saw? The Rocky Mountains. Now think about this. They'd been told there were mountains, right? They'd been told there were mountains, but these folks are from Virginia. So, now, have you ever spent time? You see what they mean by mountains in Virginia? They're talking the Smoky Mountains, the Appalachian. I'm from California. We would have made those suckers into condos a long time ago, right? Those are not mountains. The mountains are those things. And so when Meriwether Lewis literally wrote in his journal, it was the most horrible thing I've ever perceived. August 12, 1805, and they realized that everybody for 300 years and everything that they had built their entire journey on and everything they'd expected was dead wrong. Now think about this moment. You're Meriwether Lewis. Your charge is to find a water route all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and you know for sure there ain't one. You could at this moment decide to turn back, to go back to Thomas Jefferson, and your mission would be a success. Or you can look at this and decide to go over. Every time I travel into Denver, you fly into the east side of the mountains and you look up at Denver. You realize Denver is an entire city that was founded by people who braved their way all the way across the prairies, through the harsh winters, through all the turmoils, got there, looked up and went, we're staying right here. This is it. This is cool. We like this territory. It's right here, right? They had every reason to stop at that moment if they wanted to, and instead, they didn't. And in one of the most amazing stories of divine providence, they figured out that Sacagawea, the nursing mother who was there with them, brother was in the area, and that they could trade their canoes for horses, and they could head out if they wanted to. It's August, and winter's coming. They had 6 weeks to cross over the Rocky Mountains and to continue on their journey, and they chose to. How do you canoe over mountains? These were watermen. They were chosen because they were good on rivers. They were chosen because they were good hunters in the plains. The assumption of everybody in the European world and the American world at that time was that everything in front of them was exactly the same as everything behind them. That once they found over the little hump, they would then get to go downstream and they would get to use all the same skills that brought them upstream. They'd get to now use downstream. And now they discovered that they had to learn an entire new set of skills in entirely uncharted terrain. This is exactly where I think the church is today. Most of us were trained as really good water people. We were trained for canoeing. We were trained for Christendom. We were trained for this world where the skill sets are clear, the map is understood. Yes, there are dangers, and yes, you need morale, and yes, you need to be brave, and yes, there are things in front of you that you need to face, but for generations, for 300 years, people have basically all been doing it basically the same way, and now we find ourselves at this moment when for many of us we have decisions to make. Do we want to keep trying to canoe over mountains? Do we want to stay where we are? Do we want to turn back? Or do we want to give up and die? One of my friends is an old Southern pastor. He's from Alabama. He is about to retire. And he looked at me just a few months ago and he said, Todd, when I started in my ministry 40 years ago, I never asked questions about church attendance or church growth or never worried about it. Because when I started in my ministry, if a man, was not at church on Sunday, his boss asked him about it at work on Monday. That's the way our culture has changed. Right? If they're not clear on that, check the local soccer schedules, right? Like, the world no longer prioritizes Christianity. We're no longer the center of culture. We now live in a world that is dramatically different than even a generation ago. I have on my desk a copy of the Los Angeles Times from December 1963, 4 months before I was born. So in my lifetime, basically, in December of 1963, the front page is some ongoing articles about the Kennedy assassination. On the religion section, there is an article about the church that I spent 10 years training in, Hollywood Presbyterian Church. It was the largest church of the country. It had over 8,000 members. It had been featured on the cover of Life magazine. Not Christianity Today, not Christian Century, Life magazine. In this article where it talks about 8,000 member Hollywood Presbyterian Church, in the corner of the Los Angeles Times newspaper is a little cut thing that you can cut out and put on your refrigerator that gives you a Bible verse to read every day. This is the Los Angeles Times. But in 1963, the editors of the Los Angeles Times, the publishers of the Los Angeles Times, put a Bible verse that you could read every day and you could look it up in the newspaper. That's the world we came from. For many of us, the way we do church, the way we lead our congregations, the way we think about church is still built on that model. And if 1963 ever comes back, we are ready. We Presbyterians are ready to take over. We are going to do great at it. We are geared for this. We've been trained for it. We're completely ready for it. But we find ourselves in a completely different day. How do we lead our churches into uncharted territory? What is it when you're completely off the map and it's nothing like you expected? What do you do when everything that you've been taught, assumed to be true about the nature of ministry has radically begun to change? My executive presbyter, Steve Yamaguchi, tells this story. His spiritual director is a priest. The priest's brother is a jet fighter pilot. Imagine Thanksgiving at their house, right? So for the priest's birthday, the Marine Corps jet fighter pilot took the priest into a Marine Corps flight simulator. And he let him fly in a flight simulator for his birthday. Being a spiritual director who's very good at asking probing questions, he asked the question to the person who was training him, why do you spend so much time in simulators? And his answer was, at the moment of crisis, you do not rise to the occasion. You default to your training. We assume that if we get into a moment of crisis, if things are changing around us, that we will rise to the occasion. We assume that in the moment when the chips are down, we'll be able to dig down deep and find something within us that will be able to change. The truth of the matter is, they know this down to where people's lives are on the line, they train to the smallest detail. The example of this is, remember the miracle on the Hudson? Chelsea Sullenberger became a hero because 2 minutes after taking off from LaGuardia Airport, some birds hit into his engines. It caused the plane to be incapacitated. He had to land it on the Hudson River, and he landed it on the Hudson River, and not a single life was lost. He was a hero, and rightly so. He became Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade, which in my area, that's a big dang deal, right? He was interviewed all over the country. People like Matt Lauer looked at him and they asked him questions. And one of the questions that everybody wanted to ask him was, you had less than 2 minutes. You had less than 2 minutes. When you took over the plane, you knew it was going down. It was going into the Hudson River. What were you thinking about? Did your life pass before your eyes? Did you see your children? Did you think about things you hadn't said? You knew you were in this moment. What were you thinking? And his answer every time was the same. I was thinking about how to land the plane. We trained for this. The very next week, after Chelsea Sullenberger landed that plane into the Hudson River, I asked one of my pilot friends at my congregation, whose job is to go do postmortems with pilots after there have been accidents. And his answer is, yes, we have entire protocols for landing planes on rivers. They train for this. Friends, we have not been trained for the day we're in. We have not been trained as pastors or leaders or elders. We've not been trained as congregations. We have not been trained to figure out what it means to live out the mission of Christ in a world where people are not interested. One of the things that came out of our report, which work we did in the Mid-Council Commission, is that the entire church, all denominated bodies, now even most mega churches, and now in almost every place in the Western world, the church is in decline. Except for some very few exceptions, it's in decline. Up until the year 2000, you could have assumed and made a case that that had something to do with theology. Up until the year 2000, you could have made a case that more progressive theologies were leading to the decline of the church. But since 2001, that is not the case. It is across the board. We are now in a day where the church itself is following the path of Europe and is in decline. And we find ourselves in a place where we've got to recognize that we are no longer in the exact same territory. What do you do in default mode? If you default to your training, what do you usually do? What I do is I preach. I'm a good talker. I've been talking longer than anything I've ever done in my life. If talking could have changed it and if preaching could have changed it, I think our churches would have been changed. Because most of us are trained for that more than anything. Matter of fact, I mean, how many of you come out of traditions where someone will talk about seminary as going to preacher school? Or they talk about hiring a new preacher at the church. It's not that far removed. And yet what we find is that our default behaviors aren't working. Dallas Willard wrote this at Fuller Theological Seminary on the occasion of Rich Mao becoming president. Thought I'd throw this in here, knowing that Rich was coming. They did a seminar where Rich talked about theology and preaching and faith. Dallas Willard, 1993, writes, "We have counted on preaching and teaching to form faith in the hearer and on faith to form the inner life and ordered behavior of the Christian. But for whatever reason, this strategy has not turned out well. The result is that we have multitudes of professing Christians that well may be ready to die, but are obviously not ready to live and can hardly get along with themselves, much less others." That's almost 20 years ago. It cannot be solved with the existing knowledge, skills, and tools. Instead, it requires people to make a shift in values, expectations, attitudes, or habits of behavior. And this is the kind of leadership challenge that I want to talk about. What's the nature of our biggest challenges? They're systemic problems. They are problems with no clear answers. They are painful. They are costly. They are win-lose problems. They are problems where we're going to have to say yes to some things and no to others, where we're going to have to ditch the boats that we have carved by hand after a long winter so that we can have the opportunity to engage with people of a different culture who might have the resources that we need and do not have. It's going to require deep personal responsibility by every leader in every moment, and it's going to be much more difficult than we imagined. What this talks about is the notion of adaptive change. And adaptive change is about the way in which you can separate out two types of challenges. And let me just lay it out for you briefly in this way. The first type of challenge is what's called a technical problem. A technical problem means we have the ability to solve it. Matter of fact, I must have skipped the slide back here. Hang on a second. Here we go. We can apply current knowledge, skills, and tools to resolve a situation. A technical problem means that if we have best practices or an expert or wisdom that is already known, we can solve it. So if you need a heart bypass, praise be to God that you live in a day when people have developed the technical ability to do heart bypasses. Technical problems, sometimes when you get into this line of thinking, people start talking about, oh, that's just a technical solution. It's not deep enough. Well, technical solutions are great. If you can solve your church's problem with a best practices approach, do so. If you can get your kids back by building a gym, do so. Way cheaper, way easier. If you can engage the next generation by turning on a band, by using PowerPoint, by getting people to, you know, light candles, go ahead, do so. If it works, if a technical solution, a technical problem means that we have the solution within us, adaptive challenges cannot be solved with one's existing knowledge, skills, and tools. It requires people to make a shift in values, expectations, attitudes, or habits of behavior. An adaptive challenge is one where what we know is there's a history of repetitive behavior, that the problem rears itself over and over again. There's a tendency to want to flee to experts to solve it, right? So we tried the 40 days of purpose, and now we're going to try the 40 days of fasting, and next time we're going to try the 40 days of ping pong, and next day it's like we go to the next solution, right? Whenever we've done it, but they are larger systemic issues. It cannot be solved and requires people to make a change. So the first adaptive principle for figuring out how you can find a new solution is by giving back the work to the people. Give back the work to the people who experience the problem most greatly. This is deeply different than the way most of us have been taught. Most of us have been taught if our churches have a problem, it's the leader's job to solve the problem. Get the experts together. Pull together the people who can solve the problem for us. Bring in the outside consultant. Bring in the person who can analyze us. What this says is there's a different way of looking at problems where the first thing you do is you give the work back to the people who most experience it. It's the first issue. This is so deeply different than preaching, isn't it? Preaching says that the very best thing we can do is get the best preacher. If you can get the person who can put the buns in the seats and get people excited, well, that'll solve our problem. This says our problems are probably actually much, much deeper, and we must address the problems that way. This means that leadership requires learning. A gathering of people who create a community of learning. That leadership at the beginning is a process of learning. And it consists of learning that are required to address the conflicts in the values that people hold, or to diminish the gap between the values people say they have and the gap that people stand for and the reality they face. So let me give you an example. Whenever someone comes to us and says, what are we going to do about young adults? One of the most difficult things for me to have to admit before the problem can get started is, the young adults know that I'm preaching, and they're not coming. I've been a pastor there for 15 years. I don't think it's a hidden notion in our community. Matter of fact, most of the young adults who are not in our church have already heard me preach. So now the question becomes, is it a matter of maybe getting a younger model? Or perhaps there's a different way of addressing it that needs to be faced by the young adults themselves. When was the last time we gathered a group of people together to ask them what they needed in the life of a church? So on the 30th birthday of my very hip worship leader named Brianne, she invited me and the rest of our staff to come to her party. So we were the old people. We're the ones who, when they got to karaoke, we had to put the reading glasses on to figure out where the Bruce Springsteen songs were, you know. We were gathered together, and all of a sudden I realized that in the middle of this party that was made up of different people that Brianne worked with, including her colleagues that were older and her friends, there was this whole group of young adults over her age, and I knew them all. And I was saying hi to them and connecting to them and finding out about their lives. And the next week at work, I went back to Brianne and I said, so all your friends, where do they go to church? And her answer was, nowhere. She said, we've been sitting here trying to figure out how do we reach this group of friends. They're my friends. They know I'm leading worship. That's Brianne. She's the younger model. They like you, Todd. They're just not interested. I have no idea what to do. So I said to them, I said to Brianne, do you think some of them would be willing to talk to me about that? So Brianne invited 8 of her friends together at her apartment, and I came, and I just started a conversation with them on asking the question, so what is it that you're not getting out of church the way we're doing it? Why are you not coming? And where are you? And we started a 6-month group that was built around Diana Butler Bass's notion, Phyllis Tickle's notion of the rummage sale. Have you heard her talk about this? That every 500 years, Christianity has a rummage sale. That it goes and it takes its old ideas, goes up into the attic, looks at them and says, do we want to keep this or throw it away? Do we want to keep this or use it in a different way? This is funny. Here's an old hat rack, but this might look really good in the corner as a piece of art. And what I did is for 6 months, I did a theological rummage sale. I asked them about all their theology, one piece at a time, and asked them, what is it that you connected to? What is it you like about it? What is it you don't? How does it connect? And we began a conversation with them about what they were connected to. Instead of it being a church problem that I would solve, I made it a generational problem that they would attend to. Give the work back to the people and begin the process of leading. Of leading the questions of the conflicts with them. The very first meeting we had, they told me they were all Christians. They reminded me that they all loved Jesus, that they had all, most of them had all worked at camp. A number of them had been on church staffs. That was interesting. And the conflict was between the way they were living their lives and what they knew to be true and the way in which they didn't find anything in the culture that supported the way they lived out their faith. Leadership as learning is the first part. The process of learning is the first part of the shift. Adaptive leadership for the pastor involves creating an environment in which the congregation can wrestle with the competing values and implications associated with a problem. This is Jim Osterhaus. Jim Osterhaus is with TAG Consulting, a group that I work with. Jim has been my coach for the better part of 3 years and is now a colleague. Notice this notion. Creating an environment in which the congregation can wrestle with the competing values and the implications associated with a problem. Leadership is about creating that conversation, that context, that shared learning. Again, not solving it, but raising it. Adaptive principle number 2. These are all going to tie in later in the week. Change requires loss. Adaptive change always requires loss. Or to put it another way, win-win means lose-lose. If you have a win-win solution, then you probably have a technical problem, right? Win-win is the way we figure out who gets to use the copy machine and which room. Does the junior high get to use one room and does the older folks get to use the other room? And how do we make sure that they're not so loud, that they don't, you know, that VBS doesn't get in the way of the women's quilting? right? How our MOPS moms use one parking lot that is further away because our senior quilting bee is at the same time and they need to have the parking lot that's closer. We can solve those things. Those are, I mean, I'm not trying to make fun of them. If you've been in the church, you know those things. You know, you can get the blows over that kind of stuff, right? But we have the ability to do so. But the thing to recognize is in genuine adaptive change, change that requires transformation, change that requires a shift in habits and values and behaviors and beliefs, in change that requires transformation, it always requires loss. Ronald Heifetz says that leadership is disappointing your own people at a rate they can tolerate. And perhaps this is, I would say, the single biggest skill that most of us in ministry were never taught. We were never taught that the most of our life is going to be about disappointing people, about trying to figure out how to disappoint them and disappoint them in a way that they can absorb it, tolerate it, and begin to transform through it. Win-win is lose-lose, Marty Linsky and Ronald Heifetz say. And so what it means is that all transformation is also grief work. Now we're on terrain that most of us know. Now we start to realize that though we're going over a mountains, we're still traveling. And that there's something about grief work that most of us have been trained for. One of the most interesting parts about being a Presbyterian church pastor was that when we went through seminary, they made us do clinical pastoral education, right? They wanted to make sure that most of us were all required to do chaplaincy work. They wanted to make sure that we were good at a bedside and good when someone died and that we were there to be the people who are the cure of souls. They never told us the most of grief work we'd be doing would be with our congregation, about the structures that we live by, and the losses that we have to let, things we have to let go of, and the great temptation we have to try to keep our congregations on life support to the very, very end, until finally there's no quality of life left. We never looked at passages like Mark that talks about when a seed falls to the ground and dies, it bears much fruit. But if it doesn't die, it remains alone. They never taught us that the rhythm of death is not just what happens to an individual person as they go through and have to prepare to face eternity, but is the constant act of being able to be participating in the mission of God. It always requires loss. So one of the very most important things that pastors can provide are what the experts call safe holding environments. An environment where people can trust that while they're going through loss, they're not losing anything of deep value. Leadership comes down to creating conditions of trust within an organization, said Colin Powell. For the past 2 years, I worked on a commission that looked at how mid-councils, presbyteries, and synods could serve the changing discipleship context of the world. Our report said that where those councils are serving congregations that are deeply involved in mission, we have signs of health. But where those councils are serving their own self-preservation, we are dying. That question, that one statement was at the center of our report, and it was never addressed at a national level. It was completely and utterly avoided, because the most difficult thing to address was that this meant that our entire structural system had to be rethought and reconsidered. Leadership comes down to, we identified that we had a problem in leadership capacity and that we had a deep problem with trust. That we have spent, that our church has used over a generation to use regulations and rules instead of relationships and accountability. And that ultimately we have tried to regulate out the fall of humanity. We are our polity proudly proclaims that we believe in total depravity. We just think that if we can get a perfectly written motion written into the book of order, then maybe total depravity won't affect us. When the biblical model has always been to speak the truth in love, to confront evil, to speak for truth, to stay in relationship. And so creating conditions for trust is one of the most important acts of pastoral leadership. And I believe this is exactly one of the reasons why preaching is so important. Because when we preach with a sense of humility, that we know that preaching alone cannot transform. When we preach with an understanding that we are supposed to bring forth the Word of God and the Word of God alone. When we do exposition that is relevant and real. When we hold ourselves under the text and demonstrate our competence. We then at that moment create the conditions for trust in our congregation. It's 15 years ago I went to San Clemente Presbyterian Church. It was a church that had already been through a split. The pastor before me had an affair. The associate pastor before me had gone through a divorce. Both of them resigned within 6 weeks of each other. The church lost half of its members. I have a member of my church who's still there today. His responsibility was to call every family who had left our church. He called 100 young families who all had left our church to find out how they were doing, to make sure they were connecting to a new community. Is there anything we could do? Imagine what a depressing job that was. 100 families. The church was in total disarray. The church was in a deeply divided place, deeply painful over what it had gone through. They'd lost half its membership, and they called this boy who was 33 years old, who had a 3-year-old son and a daughter who had just barely been born. And together we began to rebuild the relationships. And what I said to them, when I first got there, the first thing they said to me was, "You're young, go get back our young families." And I started disappointing them at a rate they could tolerate. I said, "I believe that what we need to do is reach new families. That anybody would be willing to come back, but that God has called us to reach new people, and that this means we're going to have to radically reorder our entire ministry, and that included tearing down all of our buildings." 2000, remember 9/11? 2 weeks after 9/11, I had to stand in front of my congregation with our then $7 million building program. That was when we weren't sure if there'd be another terrorist attack. That was while the stock market had already crashed once, and it hadn't come back before it crossed again. And I looked at mostly an older group of people and said, "You called me to be your pastor. You want to reach the next generation. And what all of our studies have demonstrated is that our campus is our hindrance, and we need to tear all this to the ground." Most of these people had paid for this campus to be built in the first place. And 2 weeks after 9/11, a group of folks who were mostly average age 60 and over committed to tear down the buildings and pay for it so they could reach a new generation of people, because they had learned that they trusted each other around a common mission. The preacher serves adaptive leadership. The preacher serves adaptive leadership by being a person of technical competence and personal congruence. Preaching serves leadership by creating the safe holding environment for the congregation to do the work it needs to do. Preachers are the expert at the word. We're the most congregations we go to. We got the most experience, the most expertise at exegesis. We don't claim to be experts at anything else. We claim to be the people who will bring the word. We will do it with competence, and we'll do it with congruence, including not allowing the congregation to substitute preaching for truly adaptive change, to not believe that if we just talk about it well, we'll have accomplished it. So let me give you just a couple of further thoughts about the kind of transformational leadership that we need, then I'll open up for questions and we'll be finished. I want to give you this diagram. I've already talked to you about adaptive capacity. And what we'll spend some more time on in the rest of the week, perhaps through questions and answers, about the specifics about what I mean by having adaptive capacity. But the other two components that are necessary for truly transformational leadership are technical competence and personal congruence. That for leadership to be people who handle rightly, competently the things that they need to do, and also be people who are worthy, who engender trust. So first of all, competence. Competence builds credibility. competently interpreting the scriptures, conveying the limits of scriptures, of honestly addressing the scriptures, of being able to bring forth what it says and what it doesn't say and what we're not sure it says, and wrestling with it. When we were in the middle of this big change, one of the older women in the church came to me, and she just died about 3 weeks ago, so she's on my heart. I guess it's been about 2 months now. Her name was Ruth Kaiser, and Ruth used to walk up to me, and she'd say, "Boy," she could get away with calling me boy, "boy, I pray for you every day." And I would say, "Thank you, Ruth. We're in the middle of this big change. We're trying to tear down our buildings. People, of course, are upset, and it's hard, and it's difficult." She goes, "Boy, I don't care what you do with the buildings. As long as you preach the Bible from Genesis to Revelation and you don't mess up on that, I will support you." At first, I kind of was bugged. I was a little bit like, what I thought she was saying is, as long as I agree with you, we're fine. But what I realized what she was saying was, this is the thing where we have to trust you the most. We trust you, Pastor. Do you handle the word well? Do you bring us the scriptures? Can we trust you? And it's through that competence. And I believe that you just need to be a competent preacher. John Calvin has a section of the Institutes where he talks about the blessings of having a puny man preacher. It's in the Institutes. I wrote a blog post called "Blessed Art Thou When the Sermon Sucketh." Because what it really said was, is what he said in it is, if you have a puny man preacher, if you have a less than stellar preacher, in those moments, you know it is the work of the Spirit that is transforming you. Right? There's a blessing to being able to hold on to. There's threshold competence that's needed. We so much in the church, I can guarantee you, I go work with churches, we go and do consulting. Every time we get asked to come in, they've already considered the easier option, which is, should we fire the preacher? Maybe this would be better if we got a different pastor. Maybe if he was more dynamic, or if she was younger, or if he was smarter, or if he was fit us, or was more like us. Everybody's considered that option. A lot of times they've come to us after they've done that two or three times. And we tell them preaching is necessary. Competent preaching is necessary. Technical competence is absolutely necessary. And it's not an excuse. If we need to work on your competence, I work with Fuller Seminary's Ogilvie Institute. They do MICA groups that works on developing preachers and preacher formation. We need to be competent at a certain level and handle the word well and handle the word in a very difficult day. But that competence is never enough. Technical competence is the first part. The second part is personal congruence. Congruence leads to transparency, which builds trust. Congruence is about identity. Congruence is about clarity. Congruence means that I am the person outwardly that I claim to be, that my actions align with who I am, and that my internal life and my external actions are as consistent as they possibly can be. And that we ask all the time, do our actions express our identity? Patrick Lencioni has a new book out called Advantage. It's where he's taken all of the leadership writings he's done from all of the fables that he's done, and he's put it together in the philosophy. And he basically says the one advantage of every organization that every organization could get if they would only have enough pain to go through is the advantage of health. And health is based on clarity, knowing who you are and living it. When I work with churches that are in transitions, say looking for a new pastor, I tell them, do not do a mission statement. Do not do a mission study. If you do a mission study, you'll tell me who you wish you were. Do a self-study. Tell me who you are. What's our history? What do we believe? What are our internal values? What are our competing values? What is our history of conflict? How have we treated other pastors? What are we afraid of? What makes us anxious? Who are we? With lack of clarity, there's a lack of trust. And for most of us who are in roles of leadership, we have to always ask ourselves the question, are we clear of the difference between ourselves and our roles? The big mistake most pastors I know make is continually confuse yourself in your role. My self does not have nearly as much credibility as my role. At my church, I have this thing called the one key. It's the key that gets me into every door. I can go find the place where the cookies are. I can get into every room. I can get into every door but one. I can't get in the door where the financial records are kept. That was a deal we made. I can get into every other door. I can walk into every door because I have the one key, but the one key does not have my name on it. I can walk into any meeting at any time and interrupt any meeting at any time, and they thank me. Pastor, since you're here, would you mind giving us your opinion of what you think about this? It doesn't matter if it's a carpet committee or if it's a committee on senior ministries or if it's a committee on feeding the hungry or if it's a committee on child care or policies. Any committee, any group, any classroom, no matter what topic, I can walk in. I can walk into any conversation on the patio. I can walk into the middle of where people are praying together and they will stop praying and ask me to pray. But if I try that at home, my 15-year-old daughter says, Daddy, you're interrupting. Right? When I know the difference between my role and myself, I can talk to the congregation in a way that builds congruence. When I can say to them, I'm not an expert at this thing. I don't understand this. I struggle with this. This is where I'm competent, and this is where I'm not. We have a wonderful building. An incredible campus. And the very best decision I ever made was I was never on the building committee. You see, in seminary, I skipped the class on building and codes and sanctuaries. And so I didn't get on that committee, and I let the contractors be on that one. We developed the ability to bring transformational leadership through technical competence and personal congruence. And that personal congruence is even more important for organizations, and it's in personal congruence is where we're going to spend the time talking about ecclesiology. What is the church? Who are we? Not just what we aspire to be. What does the scripture say that we are? What does it mean to have an identity as the people of God and how that looks in the world around us? And that leads to adaptive capacity. Here's the picture I want you to see. This is a picture of a beach Bible study in my town. This was the beach Bible study that became San Clemente Presbyterian Church. This picture was up in City Hall. And for years, the caption on the bottom was blocked out. And it said, this is an early marine biology class. When they discovered and took that label off, they found the label that it actually had, which is First Sunday School held on the beach at San Clemente. Look at the picture. Do you notice some things? This is who we are. We're a church where even in the earliest days before there were buildings, there was the Bible. Even before we had sanctuaries, we didn't have a sanctuary or a campus for 28 years. 28 years, no, the early years. Women taught. This became very important the very first time I brought an associate pastor who was a woman to a church that had never had one. And children and adults learn together. We're a church that's a multi-generational church that is deeply committed to trying to reach our community. Our church was started by a group of people who used to drive 50 miles before there was a highway from Long Beach to San Clemente every Sunday afternoon, because then San Clemente was Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth. And from the very beginning, we were started by a group of people who planted a church as missionaries, and to this day, we're committed to planting churches. We've helped start one in Ladera Ranch. We've helped start another one in a Hispanic congregation. And remember that group of young adults who were met in an apartment to have a conversation around a rummage sale? Now it's the beginning of a home fellowship on Monday nights that Brianne is leading. That we've said to them, you don't need to come to church. We'll make you a worshiping community. This will be worship. You figure out how to reach your people. We've worked with them through some specific parameters, and that's the beginning of our next church plant that came not in the building, not on our campus, but because we've got a group of people together around the scriptures. Transformational leadership is about adaptive capacity, technical competence, and personal congruence. Leadership is about energizing a community of people toward their own transformation. Leadership's always about transformation. That part remains the same. It's so they can meet their greatest challenges. And one of the reasons why we need to continue to think about ecclesiology this week is I think we've confused what our greatest challenge is. That our greatest challenge continues to be the world outside of us and not just the conflicts within us. That the greatest challenge is the way the world is changing and the way we are not prepared for it. And the greatest challenge is our mission that was started in the very beginning of the first century and continues to be for this day. To energize a group of people to their own transformation consists of the learning required to address the conflicts in the values people hold, to diminish the gap between the values people say they stand for and for the reality they face. Adaptive leadership goes beyond the pulpit by giving back the work to the people. Our leadership must in every way be more and more about the way in which we engage our entire congregations in the work of addressing the changing world around them. So let me tell you about a final story. Back when we were trying to figure out how to reach those nuns, back when we were still experimenting, before we'd started the conversation with that group in the living room, when we thought what we needed was just a different kind of worship service. We started a Sunday evening service, and I went. And we decided that I wouldn't preach, because obviously that wasn't the issue. And while my young staff was preaching, and Brianne was leading in worship, at a service that was failing, I prayed and said, God, what do you want me to do? And I felt the clearest I've ever felt of the voice of the Spirit, one of the few times in my life, say very, very clearly to me, your people need you to lead them even more than preach to them. I'm a preacher. I'm a canoer. I come from the day in which leadership was preaching. To discover what the people of God is, what the church is, what the mission is, and what leadership is to give us an opportunity to find horses, to go into uncharted territory, and to find new worlds we've never been to before. But that is hard work. That's all I have to say. So I'll take a few questions and we can then be finished.